call the meeting to order. Thank you all for coming tonight to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. We appreciate you coming, and we're delighted to be in Malacca. We hear there's been a lot of legislators in Malacca lately. And we have our very favorite legislator right here, and Representative Kula Jackson. She has been doing a great job for you up at the Capitol, has been on this committee for a year now, and has let us know how important childcare is in the community and how important it is for preschool kids to get a good education. So we appreciate you inviting us here, and wanted to turn it over to you for the welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Paul. Big welcome to the people on the committee and others who drove along and those who didn't even drive very far. The fact that you take the time, though, when there are always other alternatives, other places you could be, I appreciate that very much. Our work with early childhood is so important, and I'm just proud of the fact that our part of the legislature, in the Senate, they have an E12 committee. In the House, we see early childhood education as being so important that it warrants a committee of its own, just to look at what we're doing to integrate approaches, to support early childhood care and learning on every level, statewide, and to secure adequate resources. And of course, it's a constant struggle to do that. I'm going to recognize that we have some folks here who are elected officials from the school board who want to stand up. Thank you, Beth Larson, Jody Sanders, thank you. And actually, I'm going to think we have a few enough people that we can do this. I'm interested in having everybody just quickly say who they are and sort of what their role is. Besides being a legislator, I'm the mother of three children. And my children have used daycare. They have been in preschool. Back in 1986 was my introduction with my oldest in early childhood family education. Also with us is Sarah Caruso, my little, you can introduce herself, executive director of the Children's Museum that I am very privileged to sit on the board of directors for. With that, let's just go around and introduce ourselves, starting with
Cindy here. Sure. I'm Representative Sandra Peterson. I represent Hope and Crystal. I was a life group teacher. That was my career. And I was licensed in five areas, actually. Early childhood being one of them. And actually, I worked in kindergarten and also spent most of my time in high school teaching English and working with learning disabled students. And then I was the president of the education organization for the state, mm-hmm. and for the legislature, and this is my third term. And I have enjoyed, I'm co-chair of the Early Childhood Project. And I put this on because I thought when I came to the legislature and worked with the CARE, CARE over here, it became very clear that this was an area that really needed support. And it became also very clear that it was one of the most important areas of work that I could be engaged in. And so I'm co-chair along with three other people, the House and Senate, and it's bipartisan, bicameral, and we work with all the legislators to see that we can promote and get support for the childhood program. So I'm delighted to be here, and I've enjoyed watching my 6-year-old granddaughter move through all those stages of early childhood development. Funny, I didn't notice that with my two sons, but I do remember every stage, and I want to copy everything from them together. And I realize even more how important early childhood learning is, and the output that is available for informally creating systems and programs to all stages.
Good. Well, Stacey, you did, if that's okay. I'm Laura Slawick, and I'm chair of the Early Childhood Finance Committee. I'm a state representative for Oakdale and Maplewood. So everybody knows where GRAM's international headquarters are. That's my district right there in East St. Paul. I have been doing this for 6 terms. My kids are now grown up mostly, 18 and 12, but when I started, they were a lot smaller. And did programs like ECFE, and I have one who is ECFE, which is special education. So I've been able to kind of experience the system from both sides. And I want to say we're just delighted to be in rural Minnesota. A lot of times when we're in the capital, people say, do you ever get out of the capital? So it's important for us to be here, and it's important for us to hear your concerns, and we're looking forward to listening to you tonight.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Lane. I'm just north of Minneapolis from the Good Lake Anthony area. I have 5 grown children and 4 grandchildren, and I say it's a delight to watch those grandchildren grow. I've been a teacher, I've been on the school board, and now I'm at the legislative level, starting my 2nd term.
Hi, I'm Representative Paul Wayne. I represent Bloomington and Southern Regina. And it was a pleasure to be here. I was here yesterday as well. I'm lucky enough to be vice chair of the committee. I have 2 younger sons, one is 9 and one is 7, and they're constantly in my head. There's lots and lots of energy to bring up, and I've actually had the opportunity to use many programs, and I was all really working with different providers, and it's been a crucial part of my family. So I need to push it forward.
My name is Matthew Kelly. I am an assistant to the committee.
I'm Sarah Massover, the committee administrator for the committee.
I'm Noah McKay. I am a health committee.
Daniel Lear, I work for the Health Research Department.
I'm Becky Hawkins. I work with the Alaska Legislative Assembly. I'm the
I'm Eric Howey, the President of the State of Minnesota.
I'm
Noah
Mason, who's a member of the Minnesota Early Learning Council.
Okay, so
Michelle
Sackett, I'm the Minnesota
Children's
Council, and I'm the Chair of the
Governor's
Council on Early Care and Education.
I'm Tammy Winter, and I'm the Education Director for the Alaska Legislative Assembly.
Go ahead, George.
I'm sorry, I haven't been a good campaign for you.
You're a funny guy.
Hi, Peter.
Yeah, Brett Larson with the Alaska Messenger from Iowa.
And who's next to you, Brett Larson?
Go ahead.
I'm Peter.
He's right here and here.
Okay, were you ever...
I graduated
from
Alaska earlier.
Oh, so you were a young child.
That's Orson, I'm a reading corps member at Unitarian College. My name is Jenny Campbell, I teach early childhood special education for the youth. And I'm Kenny Davis, and I'm the early childhood education for the youth in Alaska.
I'm Toby Dahl, I'm at Technical College. Along with the early childhood program at Technical College, we do a lot with the public assistance clients trying to get them to find self-sustaining jobs in childcare to keep part of that. And we do provide administrative the childcare programs like Santa County. We also have PCRNR that I see many walk in forward with us.
And I'm Bob Mannis, I work with Lincoln Pines Student Reactions and delivers heads up program on the resolution for 7 counties in which this increases in Alaska.
Jeff Larson, I'm in the Alaska School Board. I'm also the Executive Director of Donors at Health Services Extension, and we do a lot of work with families and kids in need of early childhood education and referral and support of daycare services. And I'm asking the kids to support them through the Malacca ECFE and CRISPR.
I'm
glad you're
here. I'm doing some work in the education career in ECFE. I'm Sarah Fleur, I'm a community ed and activities secretary for Monica and the facility support.
My name is Jane Stableman, and I
Control Restaurant Fair in Princeton, and Mrs. Dermot.
Hi, Dave Belair, and I'm the director at Gold Coast Shelter Service.
Tom Dalen, I'm an employee of Gold Coast.
All right. I first want to thank you all for coming and meeting us. We want to give us the opportunity to meet with you, because otherwise I wouldn't have the opportunity. Thank you so much for coming. I'm Ms. Boyle, and I'm a council member for the association. But more importantly, I'm a health specialist for Gold Coast Health Care Center. And I truly understand the need for, and the finances and needs, and the support and everything that's needed for the enrichment and education of the children that I work in the city.
Nancy Wallace, citizen. Mary Debbie.
Well, welcome everybody, and I will turn this back over to the well, actually, there's a short verdict statement that somebody who came gave me, and I read it quickly, and I just want to share it with everybody, because if I could assert myself, I would. Actually, from Candy Jacobson now, and I just want a very tiny story about Candy's role in my life, because really, my 9-year-old was here because of her. Why? I was cooking my then-boyfriend a dinner. The first dinner I would ever make him, and I wanted to impress him, and I needed to make meatballs, and I was out of eggs, and I ran across the street to Candy's house. She lent me the eggs, the dinner went well, we got married, and now. Now we have home, so thank you, Candy. And Candy, right? It is my opinion that as a society committed to educating our youngest learners, we need to provide a peaceful experience for all children prior to them entering kindergarten. As a society, we need to examine all the barriers that prevent parents from giving their children this experience. We need to find a way to reduce the barriers and make this education opportunity available to all children. As the Secretary of Education commented on a Sunday morning program, we see a trickle-down of blame. First grade teachers say kindergarten teachers aren't doing what they need to do. Kindergarten brings it down to the preschool level. Preschool puts it on the parents. Many of the parents in this district, as in many districts, are struggling to keep food on the table and a roof over their children's heads. We need to recognize that parents who come from working an 8 to 10 hour day need to get many things done in a short few hours, that many times the reading of stories, helping with homework, and doing all the things we consider essential in educating the children often are the last things that can get done in the evening. As a preschool teacher, I feel our first priority should be giving all 4-year-old children in this district, as well as all districts, an opportunity to participate in the learning readiness programs currently in place. Barriers keeping children from this opportunity need to be explored and then removed to enable all children to attend. Another priority would be to offer them all-day, everyday kindergarten program to all children assigned to kindergarten. Thanks for your thoughts. All right.
Well, thank you. I think that's a good open up the meeting. I want to just talk a little bit about how this is going to work. Is what I'd like to do is call you up in twos. So if Julie Rada and Kelly Wickstrom can come up, and we will sit in these two seats and give your testimony. After Julie and Tammy, then it'll be Lynn, Otto, and Robert Dennis, then Sarah Caruso and Glenn Benson, and then Valerie Peterson. We have allocated to about 8 twos, so we're going to try to get you out of here on time, and I know for the testifiers, the community members might have some questions for you, so give your testimony, and then we'll ask you a few questions. So, Julie, I think we're going to start with you, if you are all set. And usually, I was telling them the committee procedure when we're down to Capitol, we have some procedural things we do, like we say, welcome to a committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
I'm Julie Rhoda, and I'm a professor. I'm a school readiness teacher here at Mike Elementary School. And to share a little bit about our program, some of the good things that are happening. I think we have a really good program. This is my 10th year of teaching in the program. And by the way, I also brought my kids up in UCSC, and a lot of my good friends there, and it's just kind of a really nice start of the program. I think for parents to really get involved in the school is to start with UCSC. And so that's kind of a nice thing. Some things that I'm really proud of, I have an AmeriCorps person worker. They get a small stipend. She comes into my room every morning, and she works one-on-one with preschool kids. fiscal year in the school, in his service to kindergarten for 4-year-old students that had to be 4 years old by September 1st. She's a AmeriCorps girl, comes in every morning, and she really helps me so much because she can do one-on-one things. She's like another, you know, hand that I can work, and you know, I have her go and work on rhyming, students, letter name, letter sounds. And so that's really a wonderful program that we just had going in because of the first year and other childhood that we have had it. Another thing that we're trying to get going is an imagination library in our community. And if you don't know about that, in Greece, it's a reading program. Kelly Parton actually started it several years ago. My children were in it, and they're now both out of college. But the children get one book. Once a month, they get a child's book that would write to your house, write with their name on it. It's very exciting for the book section of books. And we are going to try to get that started by the first of the year with help from Pete Allen from First National Bank. And it costs about $30 a year for a child, per child, to get a book once a month, which I think is really reasonable. So Pete Allen at First National Bank has said that he will donate and run the program to fund it for 2 years. So that's just really a good thing that we're going to have going soon. We have about 500 to 600 preschool kids in our area. Those are just some really good things that are going on. We have really good parents that work in our program, aides that work in our ministry also. Now I'm getting to some of the barriers. From transportation, we have half-day programs. So the kids come 2 days a week, either in the morning or afternoon. So if they come in the morning, they can ride the school bus in the morning, but then they leave before lunch. So they have to get picked up and brought back 10 months to get kids. So that is a big barrier for many families. Of course, money and funding. We do have a sliding fee scale. I believe $100 a month for this twice a week half day program. That's the highest rate, and I think the lowest is $30. And even with the sliding fee scale, it's difficult for some families. Some families don't want to say that they can't really even afford that $30 a month. So I just think that that's a big barrier. And as Tammy Jacobson said, it would be so nice for all 4-year-olds to be able to have access to a program without any cost. Communication can be difficult at times, just to let people know the difference in the different programs that we have. ECSE, school readiness, preschool screening, which is mandated by the state. Every child should be screened so we can catch delays between 3 and 3.5 years old. But before kindergarten, they have to be screened. A lot of times parents don't understand that, and they will wait until right before the child goes to kindergarten. So if we do find a developmental delay, we have no chance to get an early child special ed or to get them some help. So that sometimes can be a barrier. Parent involvement, can be a strength. We have wonderful parents, especially that come out of the ECSE program. But just to get parents involved and to realize that they are the child's first teacher, that is the ECSE model. And that's really where it's at, is parent involvement, to get parents to realize they're the number one first teacher of their child, and we supplement and support everything else in our program. Any questions?
Lucy, you have questions. I was wondering, so you have the half-day program. Is that actually a school readiness program?
Yes.
Or is it funded
school readiness? Yes.
So those are kids with identified risks?
Not necessarily, no. We call them community kids. The kids with the risks that are on the IEP that qualify for special ed services, so they would be in our early child special ed program.
Okay.
School readiness is mostly for community kids.
Okay. And for preschool screening, how they have the dollar incentives in statute that between 3-year-olds you get a certain amount reimbursement from the state, 4-year-olds, a certain amount, 5-year-olds. But are you using any of, or do you try to get them in at 3?
Oh, yes, we want to try to get them in. Yeah, and that's how we can catch them. And part of that's part of the communication problem, too. Sometimes parents don't understand that it is to catch delays. That's really what we're looking for. And sometimes parents get really hung up and want the child to get 100%. So they think if I keep my kids and wait until a month before kindergarten, that they're going to pass, and we really are trying to get that out there and for parents to realize, we're not looking for that. We are looking for the delays. So the earlier the better.
Right. And do you know, you get 300 to 500 total, right? Young teacher preschoolers?
Yeah, that's the numbers that I got from the community directors who start this program from Imagination Library.
Okay.
So it's not all 4-year-olds. preschool kids.
Preschool kids. And then a lot of kids are in private child care, mm-hmm. or maybe home child care,
yes.
that type of thing.
Yes.
Okay, good. Let's see. Any questions, members? Let's go to Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about the 2-day a week, did you say 2 days a week?
2 half days.
With, okay, would the 20 hour minimum be a problem? A 12 hour? How many hours a week do you have?
The kids come for 2.5 hours twice a week. So they
would that be a problem to expand that to more time, more hours, more intensity?
No funding in space would be a big problem here in America. You know, because that would, we would have to have, you know, we'd have to have, you know, more teachers, or else we'd service less kids, and space in an elementary school, and money, of course. So it would be a, you know, it's a barrier.
But if you had the money, you would be able to get the parents to go into.
Some would. Yeah, we have a lot of people that have been asking about it, and the staff have been talking about it.
So we had a piece of legislation looked at the 12-hour minimum to get the school readiness funds.
Oh.
And so we did hear from a lot of people that that could be problematic. It sounds like, in this case, that is.
Yeah, because right now it's 6 hours a week.
Right. So, yeah, you have to double that. And as you said, then you put the kids, or mm-hmm. 8 and 9, mm-hmm. and you have to cost more with mm-hmm. twice the amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Good question. Do you have declining enrollment in the district?
Yes, we do here in America. But our preschool programs are stable. I mean, we pretty much fill up every year, and we're doing less than we're full right now.
So you're seeing improvements in the
school? Yes. Yeah, right now.
Hey, good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. You'd like to introduce yourself and just give us your testimony.
Thank you for having me. Good evening, or bonjour, morning. Don't say the Ojibwe words for hello. I'm Tammy Wickstrom. I'm the Early Education Director for Morass Early Education, which is a department in Morass Land of Ojibwe. I am a former Head Start parent. I am a former UCSE parent. I'm a former UCSE parent. So I have a lot of background in all of these early childhood programs. I have 4 children in my own. Family school ages now. So I've been a director there for 4.5 years. And Morass Education provides a variety of services. So we have Head Start, and it's kind of based in 3 different districts. We did provide a map in my handout so you can see how geographically spread out they are. We have Early Head Start, and that is in District 1, which is the Alumni District only. And that's center based Early Head Start also. We have child care that is a before and after Head Start, Early Head Start, and District 1 in Armenia. We do a very small amount of early childhood family education. Right now we're running 6 weeks of positive Indian parenting. That's part of that curriculum. We also do disability services and child funds in all 3 districts and collaborate with the local education agencies. So we are funded federally for 53 Head Start spots and 40 early Head Start spots. We're funded from the state of Minnesota for 24 spots, and we get CCDF funding that comes through the tribal CCDF programming, and then we get Morass Land funding also. So in District 1 and District 3, District 3 is way over by Easter Hinkley, for example. It's part day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 1:30, and District 2 runs an all-day program, but they follow a seasonal calendar. They go all year, and they take seasonal breaks based on cultural tradition. So they take time off in September for rising, they take time off for sugaring in the spring, and then they actually run in the summer. So we have kind of different varying schedules depending on where the kids are. We are full, fully enrolled all over. We're actually over enrolled by 6 in Head Start. And we have a waiting list in early Head Start of 52 children, which is more than our enrollment. We have 40 kids remaining. And 55% of those kids are income eligible. We have a waiting list for Head Start of 29 children, and 89% of those kids are income eligible.
We currently have 116 children living in child care services, which includes school-aged children, but in our waiting list continues to go throughout the year. About something to demonstrate, we have to follow the Head Start Performance Standards and the 2007 Head Start Act. That's what this is. These are the regulations that we are reviewing on triennially, 3 times a year. So if people always think, oh, they got cited, but it is a lot of things to be looked at. And this is Rule 3 for child care in the state of Minnesota. So when we talk about Head Start programming, there's a big difference between the standard regulation and the standard regulation. But we also are tribally licensed and following the Rock Creek statute, which very closely coincides with Rule 3. They're practically identical to Rule 3 standards. So we follow those for our council and have a review following these standards every 3 years. And in that PowerPoint, I put there's 15 areas in these standards that we're reviewing on, and we listed them out, just so that everybody has them. We are a tribal Head Start program, which is slightly different than, I'll call it regular Head Start, but tribal Head Start has a government-to-government relationship. So the chief executive signs our grants, and we are part of Region 11. The non-tribal programs are part of Region 5. Region 11 is in Washington, D.C., and federal staff participate like in our reviews, our risk management calls, because it's a government-to-government relationship. And the last band is slightly different than most tribal programs. Most tribal programs are under the tribal council, and the last band gives that governing body authority to the Menashe School Board. So Menashe is given that authority under the last band statute, Title IX, so it's just slightly different than other tribal programs, but the band still is the grantee. There is special language in the performance standards relating to enrollment. We can have a slightly higher over-income eligibility requirement, so regular Head Start only 10% being over-income. We can have 49% of our kids over-income for enrollment. There's also some language relating to like policy council foundation and some other things that are just a little bit tribal-specific. We have great collaboration on the reservation, and Head Start is a truly valued program. And so is childcare. It is viewed very positively by our parents and by the community. We get a lot of fiscal support. 50% of our funding comes from the last stand itself. So we pay no rent or no space costs in any of our 3 districts. So it's just the utility costs. They pay for a third person in every classroom in every district. They help pay for supplies. Elder speaker salaries are paid for so that the elder speakers visit the classroom to speak Ojibwe. They pay for an Ojibwe language teacher. They pay my salary. I'm not paid by any grant funding and last grant pays for my salary. So they have a lot of fiscal support and a lot of support from parents, because I would say the most angry phone calls I get is parents from, why can't I get my child in? Their parents on the waiting list. For parents, the most important thing about our program is the culture and language. We do a lot of great things. We have a powwow every month, and the Menashe High School drummers come down and they drum for our little kids once a month, and they dance, and they smile at 10:30 if anybody wants to come to powwow. So at the National School, we have a pipe ceremony once a month, which is like a blessing, and it's performed by our North Bend elder. We have a royalty powwow once a year, and we have our little Head Start Princess and Brave. That's very popular. We have elder speakers. We teach cultural values, and we have cultural lesson plans every week. And I did attach a couple in my handout so that you can see a couple. So we have a lot of cultural language activities. In our education part, we're also known for the reinforcement, and this is our 3rd year, and I have really liked the program. I've seen the kids make great gains, and I attached last year's data that showed the kids' test scores from fall, winter, to spring, so you can see the progress that they made. I really like that program. Unfortunately, we are not going to be eligible after the third year. So we can run it on our own, but we won't be able to get reading programs for the next year. We have this, which is reading is fundamental. We do 3 books 3 times a year. There is a curriculum that's research-based and developmentally appropriate. We screen all kids for developmental and health screens in the first 45 days. The kids are assessed 3 times a year. We do assessment pieces that align with the Head Start outcomes framework. For early Head Start, children are assessed 3 times a year using the Ages and Stages questionnaire. We also use the Minnesota Early Childhood Indicators for Progress for both the three to use for lesson planning and tracking for documentation about how the kids are moving forward in the Early Head Start program. We do home visits and parent-teacher conferences, each of those 2 times a year, and we have a lot of, there's no transportation provided in Early Head Start, so we do a lot of daily contact with parents have to drop off the kids and pick them up. We also have disability services in all 3 districts, and it depends on the school district. The school district will sometimes send the staff person out to our site just periodically, or mainly because we have more kids, they provided a staff person. Initially, we have a collaborative agreement. We hire someone and they're reimbursing us for their time that they're spending in Head Start. Family partnerships are important. We have great family involvement for cultural events. And we have a lot of opportunities, not just for parents, but for grandparents. Grandparents and elders are extremely valued. We have a grandparents day. The kids visit the ALU on a regular assisted living unit on a regular basis. That's a great thing. That's kind of a really thing for both age groups. We have a lot of great community partnerships. Indian Health Service, we get free. From Indian Health Service, the clinic, the dentist comes over and gives us the exams for the dental exams. We get free nutrition assessments, $30 nutrition assessments. We also collaborate with public health for health and safety, like all the H1 information and VIC. We have close communication with the social services and the NextGen Parents and Workforce. NextGen actually runs our own parents program. We don't know if they're paying for a worker in our program. There's a training, and she's training, and we pay her salary to come and see how that goes for her and help her get back to work. We have Central Lake College come. This is the second year, and the nursing students came over and did the high stakes in the healing school, and they got a pediatric contact, and we got all that stuff done very fast, and it was really great. So that was a super collaboration effort. So we also, again, do a lot of the screens within 45 days. At the end of last year, all of our kids and leaders were up to date on immunization. We have mental health observations 3 times a year. And the staffing requirements are changing in the 2007 Head Start Act. So by 2013, 50% of Head Start teachers have to have a 4-year degree in education. That's a new requirement. Right now, we have 6 teachers with a bachelor's degree, 2 with a master's degree, and 2 with an associate's degree. So we have met that requirement at this point for ourselves. And early Head Start by 2010, all infant toddler teachers have to have a CDA, which is a child development certificate. We met this requirement in the spring of 2009. We also focus on hiring parents and former parents. 40% of our staff is a parent or a former Head Start student. I just want to say that some of the costs, if you want to have a high quality staff, one of my master's teachers is, she is an awesome teacher. She has a master's degree, and if you want to pay for high quality people, that costs extra money, and without more outstanding funding, that would not be possible. So that's just something high quality staff costs money to help you pay. And I just want to, I appreciate the state of Minnesota funding that services for 24 kids and the kids want to come to school. That's an age where they want to be there and the parents want them to be there. It's recognized as a positive force in the community. Pretty much a Head Start when the tribal community calls up and asks for something. People are willing to donate it. The district representative for the band. And my wife last year donated $2,000 to us for Christmas presents for all of our kids in the world. I mean, that's a lot of money to give to our kids. There's a lot of support in the community. in Neosho schools, which were housed right in Neosho. Representatives, the last 3 years, they've said to us how the kids that come in Head Start are much better prepared for school than the kids who have not attended. And I myself just see the big changes from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, and the behavior in academic schools, and just the way how kids are feeling so positive about school. So I appreciate the funding. You know, 20% of our grant funding from the state. Now, they put a picture on the back of one of our classrooms like last year, that's 17 children. So that funding from the state funds that whole classroom plus 7 more kids. So you can see that on the faces. And the next picture is our 4th of July at Craig. That's a childhood early head start thing. And the parents just love those little things we do all the time. And the last picture is a family. And we affect not just one generation, we affect more than one. That's a grandparent, a mom, a dad, and a little girl. And I think it's important to recognize that we need to work with all generations. So thank you, Frank. I'm really rich.
Thank you. Nice job. I'm very impressed to see, particularly when you hear about regular Head Start, so it's kind of see how it's layered on with the Mille Lacs members, and it seems like a really great program. You know, the one thing I find concerning is the waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
So how long are people waiting? You know, because the problem with waiting lists for little kids is they get older. The whole time they're waiting, are they waiting a year? Or are most people getting on within a year, 2 years, 3 years?
We've had children wait 3 or 4 years to get into our program.
So they can be aging out.
Yeah, they're aging out. Especially when the early head start, they're aging out. We always have more children waiting for early head start than we even have open to our total enrollment. That happens every year. That is a space issue and it's a funding issue.
Get more space, more money.
Mm-hmm.
Could get even more.
Okay. What percentage of the students that you fixed
there?
Are you serving? Do you have percentage or do you have numbers?
Well, I don't have a percentage with me. I don't have a total. Usually I don't do a total 0 to 5 population. For the CCDF, I do like a 0 to 11. I look up for 0 to 11. Head Start haven't looked up what the 0 to 5 numbers are. So, but as you can see, if we have 40 early Head Start spots and 52 children waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's my
opinion that it would be a problem, and I think you see higher staff turnover. I think because we get some supplemental funding, our wages are a little bit higher for our program, and so we've had some longevity. I think all of my lead teachers, I don't have one that's been less than 3 years right now. So I'm seeing some longevity because of the extra funding and little boost in the salary, which I think is really critical for little kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you see just a lot of higher turnover and, you know, some trouble attracting qualified staff.
Who sets the salaries for your group?
The Neosho School Board approves the salaries.
I've got a question about the child care portion of what you do. Is that like infant to school age? And for the preschool age kids, do you have the resources to have any kind of school readiness or educational component in the child care?
In the summer, we take summer at the very limited ECFE funding, and whoever will come will run like 5 weeks, kind of an extra. It's not really school readiness, but you know, it's kind of like a school readiness program. program. So we do like a little tiny 5-week program extra. But most of the time the child care takes, because of space, we share space, so then we head start and then we stay before or after. So it's not really two separate programs. Not except for school age, usually one of the other would be involved.
Any other questions?
Yes.
What's your brain and what's your brain? Because you said that many teachers by 2015 have to have a 4-year degree. Did you say that you already met that?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Thank you for the Reading Corps program. I think there was a Reading Corps member here, and I really am a big supporter of that program.
I think that's great. I had a question about that, but you said you're not
going to
be eligible for it?
I think you can only, we can run it ourselves, but I think you can only get a member, like a volunteer member who gets the stipend for 3 years.
Okay. I see, yeah,
there's
an excellent program.
Mm-hmm.
We have presentations.
Well,
good. I think we're going to have to move on. We very much appreciate your presentations and thank you. Next, we will have Lynn, Otto, and Robert Dennis come down. While they're coming down, a couple of announcements members, remember your reimbursement forms are in your packet, so fill those out if you get a chance. Also, then next we'll have Sarah Caruso and Glenn Benson and Valerie Peterson.
Can you hear me, Paul?
I was wondering, it's, yeah, the mic is on. When he talks,
you know. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is it picking, I'm just picking up Sienna, too. Can you pick through Sammy when she talks? Okay. Well, maybe we'll try to pass it around during the committee. Good. Well, welcome to the committee. I think we're going to have Lone Stars, and then people are rather than Bob.
Bob, sometimes throw letters in there.
Welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself and the testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair and fellow committee members, my name is Renee Otto. I'm the owner of Ultra Child Care Center in Morocco, Minnesota. I'm speaking to you today about my program, the pros and cons of opening my program, and the flaws, other centers, and I see with the Department of Human Services. And maybe this will open your eyes to some of the issues you have. Okay, I'll start with the story of why I opened my center. It was March 2007. My youngest son and I were walking down the street in Morocco. Looking ahead, we saw the daycare we had gone to since the age of 3 months. He was now 6 and no longer attending the center. At that time, the center had a change in ownership, was ran poorly, and as a result, was shut down by the state. My youngest son was really mad this happened. It really bothered him. He had attended the center while it was in his prime. He felt offended that it was shut down and not taken care of. This was just not fair to the children in the community. I looked at him and suddenly felt the need to fix the problem. I said to him, Ted, let's open the center back up and give the kids in the community a fun place to go again. That was the beginning of a long, hard process with months and months of trying to get funding, trying to get correct answers, trying to get the Department of Human Services to just call me back, just trying to open my program. I find that the lack of communication and simply not being able to communicate with the appropriate persons representing the state was a huge negative factor. It prolonged my opening by several months, which in turn resulted in the loss of several families that could no longer wait for me to open. At the same time, my loan payment started, my rent started, payroll started, and I was not opening. Once the Department of Human Services finally signed off and gave the Department of Health my information, the lack of communication between the two departments and the unprofessional behavior amongst the departments themselves was unacceptable. The following are just a few things I had to deal with while trying to open my program. The first was waiting days, or in most cases weeks, for someone to return my calls from the Department of Human Services. This was very frustrating as I tried desperately to open my program.
I would have a simple question that should be able to be answered by any licensor. Sure, there's a licensor on call any day, but that doesn't mean they'll give you the answer you're looking for. I found that I was ultimately better off waiting to speak to my licensor directly, even if it took days, because in most cases, a fine licensor will make you follow the rules or as soon as they see fit. Otherwise, I found I was doing the work twice. Number two, not really having guidance as to what steps to take in opening a new program. It would be more efficient to have a licensor or someone working with the licensor that would work directly with us through the process of opening a new program, maybe mandatory meetings before the original packet of forms was ever sent off, letting us know what to expect, how long it may take for the program to truly open. If I knew service like this was available, I most definitely would have used it. It ultimately would have saved a lot of time and frustration. Number three, being guided in the wrong directions at times. For example, when the licensor visited my site before I opened to go over my policies and procedures, I was asked, who's your health consultant? I replied by giving him a name that was given to me by my licensor herself. My licensor said she had never heard of this person and did not like her work at all. So as a result, I had to rewrite all my policies and procedures, submit them, and then have them reset again. I later found out that my licensor and the hired health consultant had worked together in the past, but had some issues with each other and apparently argued over who was right and who was wrong. Once again, it prolongs my opening. Number four, being treated poorly by the Department of Health. For example, after submitting my food and food service plan review to my plan reviewer, I didn't mention her name, I was told it was wrong and not suitable to our standards. This being after I had already gotten the approval of the Department of Health in St. Cloud. I was confused and frustrated and could not believe this was happening again. I explained to her that my plan was approved by the St. Cloud office, and I needed her help in figuring out why, what she wanted me to change, and directions as to how to change it. She responded rudely by saying to me, fine, I'll just deny it, send it back, and then start all over again. I begged her not to do that, and to please just tell me what to do so I could open my doors. She finally did help me after I cried and begged for her help. Is this right? Is this how anybody should be treated? We all know this is not the way we need to treat one another, but for some odd reason, this is permitted and goes on daily to others just like myself. This was a service I paid for. I paid $350 for that service, and I felt like it really didn't matter, and she wasn't there to help me. She wanted me to grovel, and she succeeded. Number five, getting different opinions from the Department of Health. For example, I received three different opinions on several matters while trying to set up my plan review. The most logical representatives from the Department of Health were from the St. Cloud area. They were kind and professional. The most unprofessional representatives were from the Department of Health out of the city. I would get different answers, and they would fight amongst each other. This made me very uneasy and made me question whether or not they really knew what they were talking about. I spent a lot of money I didn't need to spend, and they didn't care. Once again, because of this, my opening was prolonged. Being on a very tight budget, the first year I was open, I paid my license fee twice, and my food license twice. I was only open 6 months before these license fees were due again. Is that right? How about prorating license fees for programs that get licensed mid-year? This would help out new centers, and I know it would help any other center opening. Like I said earlier, these are just a few situations I encountered while trying to open my center. All in all, I would go through it again if I had to. I'm proud of the center I've created. I can serve 85 children, and as of right now, after only a year and a half, I have 75 enrolled students. We offer Head Start services, we have great qualified staff, we offer a clean, safe, and fun environment for children and their families. Opening this center has opened my eyes to many things I never knew or realized before, like problems in the community, the poverty, how the county works, how the state works, and more. I recently visited with other daycare centers. I do visit with you. Sorry, Janine. I wanted to find out what made their jobs easier and relate these concerns to, what would make their jobs easier and relate these concerns to you. The following are the top issues brought to my attention. Number one, being consistent with Rule 3. Giving up citations over opinion rather than the actual rules or the Rule 3 manual. Example, the rules, this is just one example. The rules for what kind of paper to be used under a child getting a diaper change. This is different in each center I visited. When I asked the licensor about this, I was stopped and told that she did not discuss what goes on in other centers. All three centers have the same licensor. But all in all, this should not have been an issue. Again, all rules should be the same in all centers. This way, if a new center is going to open and they come to me or another center for advice, we can be confident in the answers we're giving them. It's important to have a good support system and in the end make the job of the licensure much easier. Number two, looking closer at experience age. Why do they need to be 20 years of age? The state needs to be looking at the full picture. How long has the employee worked in the center? What kind of training have they had? How many hours has the employee put in working directly with children? This would open the doors for using the staff person in other areas of the center and ultimately stretch the dollar for the center when we all know how expensive it is to run a quality program. Number three, not to be afraid to step forward and raise a question on the issue citation. The centers are visited with all have the same concern. We should be able to question citation when it is clearly an opinion rather than an actual rule. We know that if we raise an issue, there will be serious concerns afterwards. How will the licensor act when she comes back? Will they act unreasonably and find every little thing that they could possibly find wrong and cite us for? Will this make matters worse and make up the visit uncomfortable? These are very serious concerns from centers and concerns that shouldn't be issues at all. These concerns take up time and energy that staff would rather direct towards the students they're taking care of. Number four, county system. Marash County has a high number of drug abuse, low-income families, and poverty cases. It's a fact. Again, I do this because I opened my program. My center alone serves 9 county assistance families. Fact, we lose all of our county school students when school starts in the fall. This happens because the categories the county allows for daycare services. The county states the students must be there a total of 5.25 hours to get a daily rate. This is fine except no student falls into this category when school starts. Or the hourly rate difference is so high that the families cannot afford to have their child attend the center and are forced to have a child stay home alone. Why not have a category for before and after school rates? This is what I do for the non-assistant families that come to my center. These children in most cases are going home alone and sitting there alone until another family member arrives, whenever that may be. The county assistance program is there to help these families, not to hinder them. And when students come to the center, they work with teachers, they get to eat, they do their homework, they play games, read, do fun crafts. This seems more logical than sitting home alone. It's not too bad when the child is supposed to be the age of 12. I can handle that, but when they're 6 or 7, it's not a good thing. I felt the need and have worked hard to have a high-quality program to offer the public. This can maybe make a difference in a child's life, but all in all, by changing a few simple ways the state runs their programs, centers can save money and ultimately pay better wages, get more needed equipment, or make the center save money better, you know, running the centers. We just fix them, so any help is welcome.
Thank you.
I hope it's not someone like complaining the whole time, but
it's
what I see.
Right, no, I actually would like a copy of that. And we unfortunately have heard some more and some worse with human services and health, and we've had a number of issues. And what we do is, if this happens to any of you like us, one of the first things you should do is contact your state representative or your state senator. Yeah, and then she can start running interference with the department, because that's what we do, and then you can always pick it up to us, and then we go to the commissioner. And it takes all of that. It's so...
it's frustrating for us too.
It's like the one point I made, and I'm sure you guys find it to bring it up to your right teacher is a nightmare.
And then they usually punish you.
They punish you. They punish you. I got cited for having patent grades, and when I opened in May of 2008, it was fine. She passed me. And then she came back in the fall and said that something that a child had died. Well, mine were fine and were all brand new and everything was fine on them, but I was cited because she didn't like them. Now that's an opinion in Rule 3.
Mm-hmm.
It says we can have either or. So I went out and used, thankfully I got a grant from CCR&R and I got to get new cribs. But it shouldn't be in there if we can't use it.
Well, and I think what we'll do is, because we're in limited length there, is we're like to get a copy and we'll start to address some of those things. I think that, in our case, what we'll probably do is go to the head of licensing because we know him and he testifies for our committee and we talk to him about this. You know, if there seems to be a sort of mentality at departments, if you just sweep it under the rug or if they're out there with people and things are happening, that no one's going to talk about it. And that it's just okay to do all kinds of things. So I think that I'm dealing with it a lot more, except that it is our job to get these things straightened out. And then yours is, you're up and running.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to talk with licensing about what's happening and get a response and see why things have been allowed to deteriorate or to happen like that. Because it's not right. And it's not right for you. And you're running a business, and you're running a business that deals with kids.
And it's expensive. And every time they make it more money and more money and more, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. One other thing is put at the end of my presentation, but it's about more teens and the number of the babies that are coming in. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
It is a real big problem.
The one?
The teens that are having babies.
Oh, yeah.
It's major. It's major.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what we can do about it. I just go to small things. If you don't mind me just reading it really quick. Teen pregnancy, while I really see the need for help in this area, I see people in the infant program I run at my center, young men and women not in relationships, having babies, a lot of babies. Girls not even knowing who the fathers are, and not caring for the babies once they're born. Instead, opting to pass the child off to someone else. And in most cases, it's the grandparents. This is easier to them. Is there a program out there that can help these young teens just see what it's like, what it takes to have a child? Maybe start a program in the school system where it's a credit, you know, where it's an actual credit, but some daycare centers in the school. And it's part of a credit. Let them see what it's having to do with budget. Let them make them change a poopy diaper and clean up poop because it's a reality. But their grandparents should be taking care of themselves. The money is short for everyone, and especially for them, but they become attached, and they feel obligated into taking care of these babies that are theirs, you know, their grandkids. But it's a big problem. My daughter, who graduated 2 years ago, there was like 7 girls in her class that got pregnant. And a lot of it falls down into child care, and these kids are sitting home alone and doing whatever. They're having babies when they're 13, 14 years old.
We, you know, I was, we're going to have to go on so we can get finished, but I would say that is a national crisis, and it is something that's extremely serious, and there's several ways to address that. Our early childhood committee does not have purview over family planning and things like that, but there are state policies in some states that it goes through that, and Health and Human Services Committee, and there's policies like ours, and really K-12 education that has to deal with child care in schools. It's to all of our advantages that these young people graduate, you know, from high school and helping them to graduate if they do have a child during school, and then making sure the children are well cared for.
I think they don't get it. They act like a cult or something. That's
yeah.
What I see. I have one of my dads who gives grandma $20 a month to care for his child. That's not even enough to pay for diapers for a week.
But we'll have to talk more.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to give it to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. If you'd like to proceed or in the committee.
Yes, thank you. I'll just talk about 30
minutes.
Madam Chair, committee members, first let me acknowledge I'm a little bit out of disadvantage. I'm thanksgiving for somebody tonight.
my days of early childhood have passed. I did spend a few years in early childhood. But rather than be repetitive or boring, I guess I can not be repetitive, I can't be much about the boring part. I'll try not to repeat what Tammy did such a good job as presenting. And although she did present a rather daunting number of regulations, I would say if you've seen one Head Start program, you've seen one Head Start program. So I'm going to focus on some things that you may not be used to from Plymouth or Maplewood or Bloomington in terms of the Head Start program and what services they can offer and what they do offer more so locally here. Lakes and Plains is a 7-county area covering 6,100 square miles. We encompass 26 different school districts, and in order to maximize the philosophy that you heard both the ECSD and as a part of Head Start, the parent and the primary educator of their children, the primary focus of the Lakes and Plains Head Start program is home base. So we have teachers that go into the family's home, and our primary target is not child but parent, in order to give the parent skills in order to help their child development. Develop and to provide environmental tools for parents to help their children develop within the environment that they're in. That being said, Head Start is needs-based, community-based. So we realized some time ago that the number of families that we were working with that were working as well. And it went from 40% to 50%, 60%, and is now at 70%. So 70% of the families enrolled in the Head Start program that meet the poverty guidelines are working, either one or both parents. But it does talk to speak differently to something other than a home-based model. We also knew that we were in small communities, and the child care providers in those communities were small businesses. And it was not an attempt to go into competition with them. So we created partnerships with child care. We had one right here. And I hope you noticed in the testimony, she did testify that she provides Head Start services, and she does. She does that through a partnership with us. We did that, as I said, 15 years ago, before partnerships were encouraged or even allowed. We did it under innovative funding through the state of Minnesota. Actually, I know that the original partner that we had is in the room as well. And I can't believe it's been 15 years that we conceived this. But we could have had teachers in the child care center for the child. So by parents working, it does not exclude them from Head Start services. In our home-based model, we have written agreements of all 26 school districts around provision of service for special needs children and around shared information on expectations on kindergarten readiness. We also have 9 physical partnerships with school districts, Malacca being one, where we work cooperatively with ECFE or school readiness program in having a combined program between Head Start and ECFE and learning readiness. One thing that should be recognized is that although I spend a lot of time talking about home visits and child care partners and ECFE and home readiness, that is 1/5 of the Head Start program. We do service the most at-risk children, so we do have partnerships with 3 mental health providers covering the entire area. Our partners that fall within the health area would number in the hundreds, in that we maximize dental choice in terms of health care provision and dental provision, and we will work with those providers as well. Parent involvement is very large in that parents sit on a policy council and we say those words, and they're really close to our hearts. We assume everybody knows what they are, but it does empower parents in the learning program and having a say. They do have some powers of the governmental board of all Head Start programs. All Head Start programs have that. And we have representation from each option, which would be child care, family child care, as well as home based. And from representatives. We do have a board member here that represents childcare resources for all and for others. I will stop there. I hope that I've given you some information that's not that doesn't fit the paradigm of what Head Start is, and I would certainly like to field any questions, and I would like to take an attempt to answer a question that was already put out in terms of teacher qualifications and costs and what happens when it's not supported by the flag. There is a natural rub there. I will say this, however, Head Start is funded both federally and state. The federal funding has recognized that in terms of providing COLAs for Head Start programs that specifically go to staff. Minnesota has not recognized that. We have not received an increase in funding or COLA for quite a while. What that causes is that programs that operate both, which all of them do, provide a higher salary, and the state funding doesn't account for that. So they have to lower their enrollment in order to pay the salaries of the higher teachers. And when we're talking about waiting lists, I said I wouldn't be repetitive. I lied. Yes. Waiting list, we provide services 0 to 5. Our waiting list in 3 to 5 is over 200%. So we've got more than double on our waiting list that we can fit into our 0 to 3 programming. In our 3 to 5 program, we've got 15%.
Thank you. Any questions?
We could probably get time for one. When you do the home days, is that pretty much what we had started? Are they going to have started both? Very interesting.
It's a very opinion. A very true model of early childhood, and it really does maximize the family's primary educators or other children. So.
You give a presentation, you teach a person, right?
Pardon?
If you give a person the face, you satisfy that for one.
Exactly.
If you teach a person the face, you make it over.
Exactly.
Now, that was a paradigm that I probably wasn't familiar with this home. You're saying in terms of home, that's
I just want to follow up on the salary issue one more time. I'll try to stop Rob and so that people can hear. Does each Head Start center develop their own pay schedule, or is that done at a central location and then all of the, it's the standard across all of sites?
No, it is not standard. And this is the terminology, which is confusing me, and I'm sure it's clear to you. Each deliverer of Head Start services would have their own pay scale. In Minnesota, most of them are through community action agencies, with the exception of Duluth, which is a school district and a separate scale. Rochester is an independent, as is St. Cloud and Minneapolis are all depending. Otherwise, they're all PEPs. But each one of those also set their own pay scale. So there may be multiple centers within one program, and those would probably be consistent, but different deliveries based on geography would be consistent. Now, ours, our pay scale is consistent across all 7 counties.
Okay. Well, I think we're running out of time, so we are going to be able to ask more questions, but we appreciate you being here. If there's some follow-up we'd like to do with each one of you. So thank you. Next, we'll have Sarah Cruz and Glenn Benson. We know both of you drove up from the city, so we appreciate the kind of transitioning from the local part of the program to the statewide part of the program. I think for me, it's been very interesting hearing what's happening here locally and hearing some of the frustrations or some of the things we're experiencing too. I mean, unless we know what's happening, we can't fix it. So it's very good for us to hear what's happening. We're going to start with Wayne and then Sarah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my objective here is not so much as the what, as the why we need to do this and make the economic case. Many of you have heard it from different perspectives. Madam Chair, you and I have a mutual friend, Doug Becker, who's the CEO of Ecolab, a company that employs 60,000 people worldwide. He was asked to speak at Telluride this past month, and he called in and said, I'm supposed to talk about what this means economically to our company. He knows a way of really boiling things down. And he said, first of all, see people, and two, see companies, because that's all a company is. There's three ways to think about a company. He said, the employees, the customers, and the shareholders. Their children are important in all instances, but more important as future employees, shareholders, and customers are more important. Tom Gillespie recently said, State of Minnesota accomplished what they did because of investments they made 50 years ago. They're on the cusp of making those similar decisions now, I think, and how it will impact us. The Private College Council did a study about 6 years ago, and they looked at Minnesota and they used 2003 and 2013, that 10-year period. They looked at the population in the United States. Population of the United States will increase by 3.3%. The Midwest will decrease by 3.3%, and Minnesota will decrease by 10%. Now, those are pretty dramatic numbers. And so when I was asked to put together the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, I had in my mind 28 CEOs of large companies that I was going to hopefully get 12. When I got to 15, I stopped because I had yeses for all of them except one. And two of them said, well, ask me next year. So they all figured this out, that what we do in the earliest years makes a difference. You've heard Art Roman do the studies. We historically have looked at child care because we have the highest percent of women in the workforce. That's the way we always looked at it. I think the buying is shifting now business-wise, and they're saying this is an investment that we have to get a return on investment. You've heard Art Rolnick, I'm sure, from the Federal Reserve, an economist, who says the return on investment is 16-1. Going back to Tom Gillespie, our state demographer, who has recently said, for legislators, candidates, and everybody else, they ought to be sure of one thing. They are going to be strapped for money, and every proposal that comes before them should have the test of an ROI, a return on investment. I think that what we're talking about tonight will do quite nicely in that comparison. By the way, Tom Gillespie is wrong. It isn't a 16-1%. For 16-1 return on investment. He did that comparison on basically homogenous groups of people that 20 or 30 years ago occurred. The populations that we're dealing with in the Early Learning Foundation, 37% of the mothers did not graduate from high school, 50% are not English speaking, 65% have never seen a computer. That's a whole different population than our government is doing these evaluations. We can do this right, and the return is a lot bigger than 16-1 because of the difference in those populations. Let me say that one of the earlier people that testified brings a challenge I think we have in Minnesota and an opportunity. We do better, generally speaking, with our white populations than anybody in the country. SAT score, we do it all. Just do the worst of any state in the country. We have the biggest education gap, consistent, by the way, with pregnancy, teenage pregnancy. Our white population, our people of means, lowest in the country. They're at risk, highest in the country. So this is a story full of good news and bad news. And what ties it all together is how well we do in early education. So I think the case has been made by the Art Rolnicks of the world, certainly the CEOs that I work with, CEOs of Cargill, Best Buy, Ecolab, Blue Cross, and so on, because they get this that we're about to change. In just 10 years, we'll go from 1 in 9 people of color to 1 in 5. Those are dramatic figures, and they're happening so quick. And I must say, again, consistent with our pregnancy number, reproduction rates in the white population are not near matching the reproduction rates in other populations like this. I'm on the Minsky board at State College and University. We see it coming right through the system. 38% of our four-year students require remediation. 34% of our two-year schools require remediation. Those numbers start with ones that we're familiar with. Half of our kids are not ready for kindergarten. That tracks right on through the system. And that's kind of the sad news. The good news is, I think we can fix this. There's some predictability in what we do and how we do it. And I think the experts in delivering this system understand that a lot of it's tied to vocabulary. We know, quite frankly, that kids of parents of means, of wealth, if you will, or state of homes, have 3 or 4 times as high a vocabulary as kids at risk. There are things that we can do. It's a challenging time. We hope to be helpful in that whole discussion of helping us all find these cost-effective ways, because it's not only the right thing to do. Economically, it makes a lot of sense, and the return on investment is tremendous.
Thank you. I think what we'll do, members, is have Sarah go, and then we'll ask questions together. So I think we're first, but I had to have written all over my agenda, so I couldn't read it. No, that's why I mixed up your order. I want to say I used to be on Children's Media Board, and I was very happy to pass it on to Representative Colwood Jackson, and I hope she's doing a good job as a board member.
She's doing an outstanding job. Yes, she is.
I think she'll be great for the museum as she is for the legislature.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairwoman Stoller. I'm Sarah Caruso, and as I said in the introduction, I wear two hats as president of Minnesota Children's Museum, and I'm also the chair of the Governor's Council on Early Care and Education. And I thought I would really focus my remarks around what the Governor's Council is doing right now. And I first want to thank you for inviting me. It's been really wonderful to hear the testimony of the providers. And I just want to turn around and say, you guys are really doing a great job. I mean, these programs that you inspiring teachers and leaders have talked about are really impressive. And there's some new innovation I've never heard about Head Start being provided through current providers across a wide geographic area. That seems very innovative to me, and it's a great reminder that especially in areas that have this broad geographic dispersion, innovative programs and programs that really work, that are culturally specific and work for example, what we heard about the Native American program are really terrific. So thank you for helping me learn by being here. It's also wonderful to be in this building. I can't believe I never was a teacher because I love being in a school building. It always makes me happy, even though it is getting very close to my bedtime. So, I'm in early morning earnings again. At least jamming time. Okay, but that doesn't matter, and the governor would be shocked to hear me say that. Okay, just to give you a little background, and most of many of you know this, the Governor's Council is a recommending body to the governor and the House and the Senate on policy issues related to early care and education. We have a lot of people who care about this topic in Minnesota. We have the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. We have the Bipartisan Caucus on Early Education in the House and the Senate. And thank you for your leadership there to each of you here tonight. We have the Governor's Council, so we have a group of funders who are looking at this very carefully, and we eagerly await their sort of next phase of reporting out, which should be happening soon, I think. And so where do we sit in on the Governor's Council? And I would say we have kind of two important roles. One, we exist because of federal and state statutes, many of which you have given us to give you to think about and advise on. And so we are statutorily directing, if that's a verb, I'm not sure, to look at a variety of topics. And we have in the packet, I'm not going to get into all the details, but this is our report for the work that we have done in the first 6 months of our existence. We were officially appointed by Governor Plante, and your legislative leadership put the legislative representatives on roughly last December. And in 6 months, I think we have done a fair amount of work. The council is 17 people. We have met 3 or 4 times. We have a vision and a framework that we are working from in terms of our values and our strategies, which are bound, again, by the projects and questions which have been handed to us by statute. I do want to point out one piece that I think is important. If this council has chosen to focus on at-risk children, we feel the data is very strong, as well as the economic environment being the inverse of that, not strong, that in order to maximize public dollars behind early education, the focus should be in the near term on at-risk children, particularly children with multiple risk factors. And so that is a point of view that this council has taken. Again, I'm not going to get into all the work, but we have broken into committees. You can see how our committees are formed. One just small anecdote to share with you. These committees were wanted about 10 to 12 people outside the council on the committees. We sort of did an informal email network soliciting the interest of being on the committee. We had 116 responses in 3 weeks. So as you are hearing, as you go out around the state, people really care about this issue. And the fact that we have so many applicants, the committee discussions have been very robust, high levels of participation from around the state, both in person, people driving long ways to come to the meetings, as well as by phone. And so we have a very robust process up and running. What has given us a lot of juice is that it is likely we will receive a little more than $1 million of stimulus money, of ARRA funding. Again, coming through the federal Head Start stimulus package. And we are in the final phases of pulling together our recommendations and ideas for using that money. Because, and we had, and Representative Fowler was part of that discussion, we've had recommendations from each of these 4 committees, and we're sort of rolling that up right now. It hasn't gone back out to committee or for approval or kind of for public review yet. That will be happening in essentially early December. We have at least 2 public testimony periods which will be posted. The specifics of sort of how to participate on the Minnesota Department of Ed website. If you click to early education, all the information will be there. And we'll make sure we get the word out through this email network as well. The one piece I want to tell you about this money is that we are excited about kind of the range of programs that we want to fund, that we want to investigate. So we're going to look at kind of multiple issues. We also believe about half the money will be used to provide, will go directly to community and professionals in the early childhood community. So I personally feel very strongly as chair that the money should not be used in kind of a system administrative capacity only, but it's important even in a test pilot or a one-time basis to try to bring some of this money to families and providers. And so I think you'll see some please look for those ideas, and I hope we may meet that standard.
Thank you. For the audience, if you haven't signed up, you can go to the MDE website.
Yes.
And sign up to be on the Governor's Advisory Council email list.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what these hearings are going to be, and get a copy of this report, and kind of follow the work. It's been extensive work of the committee, so we very much appreciate your leadership, and there has really been a thorough process in developing the plan for the strategic grant. I would say, you know, here at the Capitol, we'd give you 30 seconds to testify, but since we're not, we'd ask people's indulgence. If you're willing to stay, what I'd like to do is have 1 or 2 questions, and then I'd like to get our last testifier in, so I would prefer to do it that way. Is there any questions for Ben Metzler or Fisher? I will say, I want to talk to you about follow-up in the meeting another time. And if you wonder if it was worth the drive up there, I hope you think it was, because it's really important for us. We want to have, Dwayne, we want to have you back in front of the committee. If not, this session this summer to talk about what's going to be happening with MELF, because it's aspiring, right?
At the end of 2011.
Is that the end of 2011?
Yes.
Okay. We need to start having a conversation with the legislature about what we're going to do about that. And also, if y'all haven't heard, Sarah Cruz is the new head of United Way in the Twin Cities. She got a promotion, and I think that's exciting and fortunate for all of us. She will be the third largest United Way in the country. Highest ranking female United Way person. I started out with United Way, so I just think that's a big deal. So we miss your work at the meeting.
Yes.
Instead of become the highest ranking female CEO of United Way in the country.
Right? Really?
Yeah, and that's actually a big deal. So we appreciate you getting to visit with a new person at the museum, but we appreciate you coming today and your work for the Writing Council and for
Thank you.
Thank you. But last, we will have Valerie. Did you come here anywhere so she's coming down? So we can close out the pieces and let them go with Jackson.
Wrap up
a little bit, so then we'll have her go.
Oh, okay. Again, thank you so much for your time, for your indulgence, and staying later. If your perceptions of this or anything like mine, it's been a lot of really great information, both from the people here. I'm so proud of the people that I invited from my community, because they really are good spokespeople for the good things that we're doing here, and really candid about the challenges, because we need to know about that. So thank you all again. Thank you, citizens, for coming, because this is, we're all in this together. We are the village, and together we can make a wonderful thing. Thank you to the people who go so far to be up here. This is my community. I love it here. It's a very important place to me. And it's a wonderful privilege and opportunity to invite people, have you up, let you know what we're doing here in rural Minnesota.
Thank you. And that will proceed to our last testifier, Valerie Pearson. If you want to welcome the committee or introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Valerie Pearson, and I'm representing the Minnesota Child Care Resource Referral Network, which is located in St. Paul, but I do live most of the area. Spent most of my adult, most of my life in the Cambridge area, and now I'm over in Chicago County. So I'm happy to be here, and just wanted to give you, I will keep it very brief because the building already said a lot of the good stuff. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on the resource referral system, both at the network, at the statewide level, and then we'll be able to hear from the local level. So if there are questions about that, we'll tap on into her as well. But the Child Care Resource Referral Community in Minnesota works to help families find child care and understand their child care options, and also works to support child care providers through grants and education, scholarships, those kinds of things. We really recognize that children's experiences in their early life last their whole lifetime, that the first 5 years represents a really fantastic rate of growth and brain development for them. We've really turned our focus more and more each year toward developing quality in child care providers throughout the state and throughout across the different kinds of early experiences that are still getting us the Head Start and the child care. As well. So you've got a little kind of a PowerPoint, some slides there, and I'm not going to read them for you. I'll let you look at them in your own time, but I just wanted to point out some of the reasons why quality is an important piece for us right now, and we think it's important for the early childhood system as a whole. We really recognize that although class sizes and ratios and some of those things that you've heard about our patients of quality, we really know that it also takes high quality interactions between caregivers and children, and that we believe that professional development is key for child care providers. There was some studies that were done in Kansas City, and children who were attending programs where caregivers and teachers take curriculum training showed statistically significant improvement in the receptive language and social skills, which we know are key components to school readiness. Children in literacy reading environments also showed improved fluency in learning their letters and other important pre-reading skills. We've heard a little bit about literacy rich environments already tonight. We really want to work on building a system throughout the state that can help to build that quality, which is why we've been looking at the nationwide trend toward quality rating systems. And we have been working along with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation in exploring different options for how a quality rating system might look in Minnesota. We know that we would like to have that include highly skilled teachers, age-appropriate curriculum and stimulating materials, safe physical environments for children, language-rich environments, warm, responsive interactions between staff and children, and high and consistent levels of child participation in activities. As the child care resource and referral system, we're providing trainings. Last year, we provided over 2,200 trainings for child care professionals. We've granted 166 teacher scholarships to help providers get higher education, and given over $2 million worth of grants for providers to improve quality. And we want to continue our commitment to that kind of work. And the main thing that we're doing right now in regards to quality rating systems is that we are the state coordinator of the Parent Aware program, which is a pilot quality rating system that we are currently operating in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Wayzata, and then three of Minnesota counties in southern Minnesota. We are looking forward to a comprehensive research report. Year two will be coming out now in December, and we'll make sure that all of you get that information. And we'll be taking the information that we get there and moving forward with that quality rating system. So we look forward to your support in that process and a two-way conversation about how that's going.
So the year two report on the Parent Aware is coming out this December. And then what's that last report everybody keeps talking about? Is that a year from December? Or?
Yeah.
And that would be the final sort of evaluation.
Yeah, although as a legislature, you gave us an additional year with the fair funds this year. So we will actually still have some of the pilot left after that last. So we'll have time to maybe correct course a little bit or try some changes.
Well, thank you. We're sorry to go last. We appreciate you all being here, and thank you for hosting us. For coming to Jackson, and perhaps we'll come back in Atlanta one day. We will see you at the Capitol. We're having two more hearings. If you're interested, we're going to represent the Rosenthal's district. Do you know when that is?
January.
So if you want to be down the cities and you want to come, it'll be a variety of topics on early childhood in the diner of Bloomington. Bloomington. And then we also have one in Carlos Mariani's district, which is St. Paul, and that'll also be sometime in January. And also, are committees on Mondays and Wednesdays? Tuesdays and Thursdays. From 4:30 to 6. So if you're down at the Capitol, or down, stop and say hello, or stop into a committee meeting, you're always welcome, and I would love to have you. Participation that we're doing. Okay, well thank you. That meeting is adjourned.